And so it was that the Tsar, the Orthodox Tsar, put this squash on the rescue plans not simply because of worries for himself and his close family, not simply for we who served them, but for those thugs who guarded them and were soon to kill them. How could he have been so stupid? Didn't Nikolai see the tidal wave of blood flooding toward them, toward all of Russia? Oh, as the tragedies of Shakespeare have revealed, the fall of kings is but fodder for the richest of entertainments. The tumble of this Tsar and his consort was the grossest, however, and the conclusion of this story, I regret to foreshadow, was all the worse. In those days, as the imperial family sat unknowingly waiting for their own executions, the Tsar's younger brother, that sweet, dashing Grand Duke Mikhail, was taken out into a field and shot like a dog. And the Tsaritsa's sister, Grand Duchess Elizaveta, she and a handful of other Romanovs were thrown alive down a mine shaft with hand grenades and burning brush tossed in atop them. Unfortunately, they lived through it all, singing praise to the Lord, until hunger itself took them days later. This we know to be true, for dirt was found in their stomachs once their bodies were exhumed. Such were the times. So black. So crazy. Какой кошмар. What a nightmare. 12. Lord, forgive me, but first make me suffer. I am the devil's creation. Torture me and make me cry out for mercy, but make me suffer. For history shows that it was my grave error that precipitated the murder of the Tsar and his family. Yes, my dear granddaughter Katya, I confess that it was my stupidity, an ignorant decision by a lowly kitchen boy that gave the Bolsheviki the excuse they had been seeking. By July 5th, the revolution was collapsing in all directions. The Bolsheviki were terrified, for their defeat seemed but days away. The Germans controlled the Ukraine, the English had landed in the north, the Japanese had invaded the Far East, and the American Marines were on their way, albeit slowly. Why, even in Moscow itself, there was a revolt of the Social Revolutionary Party against Lenin and his depraved cronies. In other words, Lenin and the Bolsheviki were not only cornered, but desperate, which, naturally, made them more dangerous than ever. It was a Friday, not hot, not like the days before, but a pleasant 13 degrees. The rains resumed, which would pose a problem for the night of July 16th to 17th. Yet on the 5th, things seemed ready to burst with hope and promise. Not only had the Volgardev and his crew been replaced by a new commandant and new guards, but Sister Antonina and Novice Marina arrived, their arms laden with a bounty of wondrous supplies. They had not come for days, and suddenly they appeared, smiles beaming upon their faces as they carried in foodstuffs the likes of which we hadn't seen for months, not since we'd been carried off from Tobolsk. Instead of just milk and a meager basket of eggs, now there were 2/4 of milk, 1 large basket containing a chort of adusina, a devil's dozen of fresh warm eggs, not to mention a glass bottle of thick cream, a generous amount of tvarog, farmer's cheese, and even enough meat for 6 days' soup. "Oi!" I gasped as I helped the good nun and her novice into our little makeshift kitchen. "Tak mnogo vsevo!" So much of everything. Sister Antonina, tiny and round as she was, squinched up her nose like an old hedgehog and said, "During our day, if we brought this much and more every time, But there was a toll, per se.
What?
Da, at the outer gate, at the inner gate, as we walked past the guard's room, they all took as they pleased.
Novice Marina, her voice small, asserted,
It's true, they wouldn't let us pass otherwise.
Now that we know the way is clear, beamed the good sister, next time we will bring even more.
When we walked into the tiny kitchen,
Cook Kharitonov saw the goods and was beside himself, putting aside his boiled potatoes and immediately bragging about what he would make.
Maybe even some meat pierogi.
I placed the larger of the baskets upon the kitchen table and fetched a bowl for the eggs. As I unloaded them, the young novice Marina stepped forward, clutching dearly one of the chetverts of milk, which she lifted unto my hands. I gazed into her eyes, perceived the most subtle of nods, which sent a rush of excitement up my spine. And yes, the tiny pocket cut into the cork did in fact contain a note, the fourth and final one the Tsar was ever to receive. No sooner had Sister Antonina and Novice Marina departed than Big Dr. Botkin appeared in the kitchen doorway. Everyone was hoping for more news from the outside, and he pushed up his gold spectacles and studied me quite eagerly.
"Would you be so kind, Lunka, as to fetch a glass of water for Alexandra Fyodorovna?" he requested, his dentures oddly clicking as he spoke. "Her eyes are aching, and I have prescribed valerian drops to calm her nerves."
"Certainly," I replied. I did as requested. As before, I removed the cloth covering the crock of water, ladled a glass of fresh cool water, and set upon my way to the bedchamber. As I traversed the dining room, I fell under the stern eyes of one of the new guards.
Did he know? Could he guess?
Yet, that would be impossible. I just had to maintain a certain composure, and I continued through the doorless passage into the girls' room, finding the three older grand duchesses on their beds reading, and Anastasia on the floor, playing with Jimmy, her little King Charlie. Next, I proceeded into the corner chamber, that of Nikolai and his consort. The Empress herself was reclined atop her bed, one hand over her closed eyes, while Alexei sat in his nearby bed, making a chain out of a piece of copper wire. The Tsar was there too, seated in a comfortable chair by the window, reading another volume by Saltykov.
"Ah, Lunka, spasibo bolshoye."
"Thank you very much," said Nikolai, rising to his feet, at the same time brushing back his mustache with the back of his hand. "Here, let me take that." I approached him, handing him the glass of water. In the most quiet of voices, he asked, "Did Sister Antonina bring something today?"
"Das."
I immediately reached into my shirt, where I had hidden the small folded note. Just at that particular time came frightful coughing from the room of the Grand Duchesses. We all knew what that meant. The Tsar whispered, "Bistre, quickly." I heard them now, the heavy steps of a guard marching our way, and I nearly panicked. Finally, my fingers found the small folded paper, and I ripped it from my clothing and stuffed it into the Tsar's hand.
"Ah, good morning, Commandant," said Nikolai, palming the note to his side and into his pocket. "The heat has finally broken, has it not?"
I turned around, saw the new commandant, Yakov Yurovsky, who just the day before had replaced Avdeyev, the red pig. This new keeper was a trim man, not too tall. He had thick black hair, a black goatee, nice eyes, small ears, and a distinct, rather unpleasant voice that sounded as if he spoke through his nose.
"Good morning," said the dark one, so very matter-of-factly, as he held forward a wooden box. "I have here in this wooden casket the items of value that you gave me yesterday."
Alexandra, never one to hold her tongue, gazed at him from her bed, and all but hissed, "We gave you nothing. What you have is what you took from us." That was yesterday's incident. Yurovsky had arrived midday, and that very afternoon he and another had gathered the imperial family and demanded their personal jewelry, lest it tempt the guards.
"You took all the jewels we were wearing," continued the Empress, "except two bracelets for my Uncle Leo and my husband's engagement ring, things that cannot be removed without tools. I have done so for your own protection."
"Protection? From what? Your people?"
"I'm afraid you're too late. Our trunks in the shed out back have already been looted." "An unfortunate incident," replied Yurovsky, his eyes spitting hate. "But it will not happen again. Comrade Avdeyev and some of the other house guards have been removed and sent to the front for actions unbecoming the revolution."
Ever the gentleman, Nikolai said, "I pity Avdeyev, but he is to blame for not restraining his people."
"Perhaps, but that is not your concern."
"In any case, we appreciate your attempts to restore order."
"Yes, even the Tsar loved to feel the whip of authority and control. He disdained slovenliness and disorder, and in those first few days he appreciated the soldierly conduct of this new commandant, Yakov Yurovsky. Little did the Tsar or any of us know that Yurovsky was totally committed to one thing and one thing only, the difficult duties of the revolution, that is, murder. Along with Yurovsky came an entirely new interior guard made up of Letts. These guards, these emissaries of the underworld, however, were not made up only of Latvians, who played so strong a role in the Cheka, the forerunner of the KGB. No, this new group of burly men comprised a strange mixture of Magyars, Germans, Austrians, and Russians, a vile mixture of men divorced from God and country and certainly Tsar. In spirit, they were all true revolutionaries, men who had thoroughly justified killing as a means to an end. The only consolation I have found is in my books, where it is written that all these men died the most hideous deaths, including Yurovsky himself, who died from a wonderfully painful cancer that curled up his throat in 1938. Not only that, but he lived and suffered just long enough to see his beloved daughter Rima tossed into one of Stalin's gulags, where she languished for another 20 years. Placing the wooden casket upon a table, Yurovsky opened it and instructed, "You are to verify my list and verify the items in the box. When you have done this, I will seal the box."
"And then what will you do with our things?"
said Alexandra, her irritation clear as she rose from the bed. "Take them away again? Allow your soldiers to steal from us, as before?" "Yet, I will leave this box here in your room and here on this table. It must remain sealed, however, and this I will check each and every day. I assure you there will be no incidents, not as long as you do not provoke them." "The only incidents have been due to the incompetence of your people. We, on the other hand, have been more than cooperative." I could see that Yurovsky would have loved to have slapped her, but instead he held himself in check. Perhaps he was laughing on the inside, chuckling, because he knew that a bullet was coming her way. And yet he forestalled any provocation. He merely nodded as he reached into his pocket and pulled out his trump card. You see, he was conniving to win their trust, angling to make their murders as easy as possible, for he was well aware that lambs were easier to lead to the slaughter than wolves. "I believe these are yours," he said, as he placed a handful of silver spoons upon the table. Alexandra looked at the silverware, her eyes wide with surprise.
Why, yes. Wherever did you find them?"
"They were stolen from the shed and buried in the garden."
"Our gratitude," said Nikolai, stepping forward. "So, let us have a look at your list and the contents of this box. You have our word of honor that this seal will not be broken." Right then and there I watched as Nikolai and Alexandra reached into the small casket and withdrew a packet. They poured out its contents, their most personal jewelry, exposing nothing fancy, not by any means. Nice pieces they were. Rings, simple diamond earrings of maybe 15 carats each, lockets, gold bracelets, gold chains with crosses.
The former Tsar and Tsaritsa sorted through it all, made sure each piece was listed. Several minutes later, they slid their belongings back into the packet, which Yurovsky took and placed inside the wooden casket.
"I will place the spoons in here as well."
The commandant did just that, then sealed the box with a piece of wire and some red wax.
"As I said, this box is to remain on this table and is to remain sealed. I will check it every day, and if I see that it has been tampered with, I will remove it."
Alexandra Fyodorovna smoldered. You could see it in her face, which blossomed a blotchy, angry red. Nikolai Alexandrovich, on the other hand, never wavered, never betrayed his inner thoughts, and was, as usual, amazingly self-controlled and circumspect. "We understand," he calmly replied, "though I'm sure inside he too plays with anger." Yurovsky turned to leave, but rather than disappearing like a quick black cloud, he eyed the boy and descended upon him. I watched as the emperor and empress stiffened, but said nothing.
"And how are you feeling today, Alyosha?"
asked the commandant as he seated himself on the edge of the heir's bed. Alexei glanced at his parents before replying, "I am well, thank you."
"Are you walking yet?"
"I have been able to stand, but not walk, not as of yet." Yurovsky, once a watchmaker, later a photographer, and still later a medic, loved to dole out advice and said,
"Well, you must get plenty of rest and eat lots of eggs and meat so as to get your strength up. Agreed?"
Alexei nodded with the grace of his father, though he said nothing further, for he was infused as well with his mother's pride. The heir's dog, Joy, came trotting in just then, and the commandant rose from the edge of Alexei's bed and gave the pup a pat on the head. As he headed out of the room, Yurovsky said,
"Well, I'm quite sure your four-legged friend here will watch over you."
How did he do it? With blood on his mind. How did Yurovsky go about interacting with this husband and wife and these children?
Once I made my grave error, it was this Commandant Yurovsky himself who went about so calmly orchestrating the execution. It was he as well who fired the first shot, and it was he who led the haphazard burial team off into the pine wood.
In any case, the minor incident with Yurovsky was soon overshadowed by hope. Hope provoked by the final note that Sister Antonina and Novice Marina had just smuggled in. As with all the others, it too was in French, and it too survived those awful days. "The change in guards and in the commandant prevented us from writing to you. Do you know what the cause of this was?" "We answer your questions. We are a group of officers in the Russian army who have not lost consciousness of our duty before Tsar and country. We are not informing you in detail about ourselves for reasons you can understand, but your friends D and T, who are already safe, know us. The hour of deliberation is approaching, and the days of the usurpers are numbered. In any case, the Slavic armies are advancing toward Yekaterinburg. They are a few versts from the city. The moment is becoming critical, and now bloodshed must not be feared. Do not forget that the Bolsheviki will, in the end, be ready to commit any crime. The moment has come. We must act. Rest assured that the machine gun downstairs will not be dangerous. As for the commandant, we will know how to take him away. Wait for a whistle toward midnight. That will be the signal. An officer." And here, I must ask, is the wisdom of my years clear now? Have I not seen things that no human should?
13.
Wait for a whistle toward midnight. Such enticing words. To the ends of the earth, Romeo could have thus enticed his Juliet, Heathcliff his Cathy, even Zhivago his Lara. Such promise lies in those words. Such hope. Such beauty. Alexandra herself whispered how she hoped for 300 loyal officers to come charging into town, whooping and hollering and whisking us all to safety. So excited, so agitated was she, that in those final days the Empress scarcely rested or slept, fidgeting and turning with every sound. The Tsar, meanwhile, never stopped pacing. In the dining room, in the drawing room, in the garden, he paced his soldierly step back and forth, waiting, praying, hoping, and eventually despairing, for he understood that his fate, which had long been waiting on the horizon like a black storm, was finally, and at last, set to arrive. True, just then, and for a few days that followed, our candle of hope burned so bright, so strong, we found hope in everything. From the heavy evening rains that cooled the air, to our dinner table, which was spread with more plentiful food than we had seen for months. The nights of July 5th and 6th, we were again secretly advised to sleep fully clothed, which, in fact, we did. And again, none of us slept well, listening as we did for that blasted whistle which was never to come. Not ever. I don't know quite what happened, why this attempt to rescue the Romanovs never materialized. Perhaps the Tsarist plot was discovered. Perhaps the officers lost their nerve. Perhaps their leaders were killed. Or perhaps they simply ran away with the pile of money sent by Anna Virubova. But something went terribly awry. That night, I lay on my bed, my ears stretching for midnight hope, yet only hearing the stomp of the guards outside and fighting cats and a woman screaming at her drunk husband.
Boya, get inside at once!
Once I was awakened by the report of a gunshot, a sharp blast that split the night. I sat up in my makeshift bed, a pile of blankets on the floor, and saw Cook Khoritonov stir as well. Was this it? The beginning of the loyal officers' siege upon our prisonly house? Were we about to be carried away by faithful Cossacks? But then there was nothing. Khoritonov just rolled over, tumbled back into sleep. And I just sat there, staring at the room's lone window that was veiled in lime. The minutes crawled past, and I lay back down on the floor, overcome with a sense of hopelessness and eventually exhaustion. Toward morning came the sound of war, and it increased every day from then on. Of course, we could see none of this, not simply because of the double palisade surrounding the house of special purpose, but because of the limed windows. But like blind people, we became particularly attuned to noises from beyond. Each time there came the sound of something momentous, the sound of hooves, the rumble of a motor lorry or two, a great pause passed through the house. The Emperor would cease his pacing, the Empress her secret stitching, Demidova her cleaning, and Khoritonov his chopping. What was that, a military or civilian wagon? Red soldier or white savior? Was it the time of our rescue or the time of... We heard nothing more, not ever again, from these so-called officers. The Empress became so nervous and the Emperor so frustrated that he finally wrote a note begging for information. It was this note, entrusted to me by the Tsar, and discovered by Yurovsky, that provided the excuse the Bolsheviki had been searching so hungrily for. But why was there no rescue? Why? Earlier that past winter in Tobolsk town, the Romanovs could easily have escaped. The troops assigned to guard them had been nearly all won over by the imperial family's charm, and Nikolai could have effected escape by simply and quickly leaving town, fleeing to the great north and into the depths of Siberia. But the Tsar nobly felt an obligation not to stir up trouble, not to leave Russia. And so by the time they'd been transferred to that red hotbed, the city of Yekaterinburg, it was too late. But But why did no rescuers appear by the light of the summer moon? By that July, there were only several hundred Red troops in all of Yekaterinburg. The Whites, only 20 miles away, had seized towns all around and were poised to attack from any number of directions. We all knew the city was destined to fall any day, so why was nothing attempted? In those few days that followed, there came through our single open window only tidbits of normal life and no whistle. Locked in the house of special purpose, we waited. And as the time went by, our hope fell away. It was on Thursday, July 11th, that we finally realized just how desperate, even hopeless, our situation truly was. To break the tremendous boredom, the air and I were once again playing, not Troika or English Tank, our two most favorite games, but Elevator. One of the doors off the dining room was a pocket door that, much to our amusement, slid sideways in and out of the wall, rather like an elevator's. And Alexei, seated in the wheeling chaise, and I by his side, pretended we were riding all the way to the top of one of those new American buildings that rose so high above the ground, 12 floors, and, they claimed, scraped the sky. We weren't even to the 5th floor, when we suddenly saw the Grand Duchesses and Dr. Botkin hurrying through the dining room. Alexei said, "Hey, something's going on." The heir pointed with his right hand, and I, the consummate companion and lackey, immediately obeyed. I pushed him off our make-believe lift, steered him quickly through the dining room, through his sister's room, and into his parents. There we found the Emperor and Empress, all the girls, and the doctor staring at the one open window, a look of great grief upon all of their faces.
"What is it, Papa?"
demanded Alexei. "They're not sealing the window again, are they?" The Tsar silently came over, rested his hand on Alexei's shoulder, and softly, almost painfully, replied, "No, they're putting some kind of covering over it." In a kind of shock, we watched as 2 ladders were thrown up against the side of the house, and 3 workers lifted a heavy metal grating. With no small effort, they attached the bars to the outside of the window frame. The limed-over windows were terrible enough, but this was worse, for within a matter of 10 minutes, we were securely behind the bars. Wasn't it through this window we were supposed to flee? Wasn't our path to freedom now completely blocked? Was rescue now impossible?
"Oh, Nicky,"
gasped Alexandra, as she clung to her husband's arm. Bit by bit, day by day, our world was shrinking. No longer did it seem as if we were merely under house arrest. Now, looking through those black iron bars, we all realized we were imprisoned, locked in a kind of grand cell from which there might well be no escape. Nikolai, stroking his mustache, said, and with no warning,
"You don't think our friends on the outside have been discovered, do you?"
"There's no way of telling, though the guards certainly seem afraid of something. In any case, I'm starting to like this Yurovsky less and less."
Behind us came steps, and the commandant, entering the room, said in that nasally voice of his,
"Do you have a comment, Citizen Romanov?"
The Tsar turned around and asked, "Do you really have such fear of our climbing out or getting in touch with the sentry?"
"My orders are to guard the former Tsar.
As I've said, I would never leave my family."
"I have my orders."
Yurovsky then held up his small leather box.
"I found this in the service room, stolen, I believe, from your trunk."
Nikolai took the box and opened it, revealing his gold watch. "Thank you for returning it."
"I will allow you to keep it in your possession, but for security purposes, I suggest you wear it at all times."
Yurovsky turned and departed, and the Tsar took his watch and fastened it around his left wrist. A beautiful gold watch it was, naturally of the finest quality, and he wore it unto his death,
when it was taken as a brilliant souvenir from his dead body.
"Oh, Nicky," said Alexandra.
The Tsaritsa felt the pains of the world in her head, her back, and in her legs, and Nikolai helped his beloved back to her bed, where she reclined and stayed for the rest of that day and actually almost for the short remainder of her life. It was about then that our dear Dr. Botkin began his prophetic letter, the famous one found after the night of treachery. He began it at about this time, and was still working on the wording all the way to the end. In fact, he was still writing it that night, when they were all called down to the cellar. In retrospect, it was clear that the end was rapidly approaching. Dr. Botkin foresaw that. I, on the other hand, never stopped believing that we would be spirited away. Then again, I was but a lad of 14, as naive to the depravity of mankind as I am wise today. And so it is with great sadness that I proceed to Sunday, July 14th. 14. A Sunday it was, just 2 days until the end. For days we had not been visited by Dr. Derevenka, the heir's physician, and for days now the Tsar had been requesting his presence. My son needs the attention of our Dr. Derevenka, who possesses a unique electric device. He uses this to massage my son's legs, you understand, and the results are quite good. And as I've told you before, countered Yurovsky, this is not permitted. Likewise, the Tsar had been asking for a religious service, which had not been permitted for quite some time. Then, all of a sudden, that Sunday, the 14th, we were informed at morning inspection that we would be allowed a service to be performed by none other than Father Storozhev himself. He and the deacon will be here at 10 this morning, said Yurovsky. No conversation will be permitted. Understood, curtly replied the Tsar. Morning tea and bread were served immediately after the inspection, and the announcement of the religious service caused a great stir at the table, albeit a quiet one, for a guard stood at either end of the dining room. That left us not much to talk about except the weather, and a beautiful summer's morning it was, the sky having cleared after another night of heavy rain, and the temperature was now a cool, pleasant 12 degrees. As soon as breakfast was concluded, however, everyone scattered. Charitonov, Demidova, and I went about cleaning the table and doing the dishes, while Alexandra and the two younger girls, Maria and Anastasia, set up a small altar in the drawing room. They cleared the large desk and decorated it quite nicely, spreading one of the Empress's shawls over it, then arranging their favorite icons, including St. Fyodor's Mother of God, perhaps the Empress's most treasured possession. Adding a nice homey touch, Anastasia placed a few birch branches here and there. For, whether of high or low estate, Russians are a mystical sort, bound like pagans to the wild nature of their motherland. At this time, the Tsar retired to his bedchamber, presumably to sit with the heir, perhaps even to read to him. This, however, was not the case. A few minutes later, Olga slipped into the room, and it was then that they wrote the final letter to the officer. It had been 10 entire days since we'd last heard anything from the outside. 10 entire days of waiting for that bloody midnight whistle, and the Tsar wished to inform those on the outside that the conditions within the House of Special Purpose were deteriorating. Rapidly so. Of course, the Tsar, always cautious, controlled, and particular, was not a quick writer by any means, and it took him a good long while to draft the 6 or 7 lines. Then, of course, Olga had to translate it into the French, so this entire process took all the way up until the service itself. Shortly after 10, the servant Trupp brought the brass censer with burning coals, handing it to me in the kitchen and requesting, "Please deliver this to Father, who is in the guard's room." I did as told, carrying the brass censer, suspended as it was by 3 chains. A rich plume of heavenly smoke billowed out as I walked through the house and to the guard room, where I found Yurovsky and the guard, plus the two from the church, Father Archpresbyter Storozhev and Father Deacon Buimirov. The two religious men were already vested, their gold and red brocade robes flowing to the ground, and Father Storozhev was in conversation with the commandant himself.
"So, what is the matter with your hands?" asked Yurovsky with a small smile. "Why is it you keep rubbing them?"
"I am trying to ward off a chill, for I fear the return of pleurisy, from which I have only recently recovered," replied Father Storozhev.
"Ah, now, of these things I know, for not only am I a trained medic, but I myself have had an operation on my lungs."
Yurovsky proceeded to dole out his free advice, and when he was finished, we were told to proceed into the living room. First went Father Archpresbyter, then Father Deacon, Yurovsky, and finally me. Just as we entered, Nikolai Alexandrovich, dressed in his khaki field shirt, khaki pants, and his high leather boots, came through the doors from the dining room, the two younger daughters behind him.
"Well, are all of your people present?" asked Yurovsky.
The Tsar nodded toward those at the front of the room.
"Yes, all."
The Tsaritsa, wearing the same dark blue cotton dress she'd worn for weeks, was seated next to the heir, who was in the wheeling chaise and wearing a jacket with a sailor's collar. The older daughters stood nearby. All four girls had changed, and now were dressed nearly identically in dark skirts and simple white jackets, the same simple jackets that usually hung at the foot of their cots. The Tsar took his place at the head of the family. On the edge of the living room stood Dr. Botkin, Demidova, the tall Trapp, the short and stocky Kharitonov, and me, the youngest and the last. Once we had assumed our positions, the Abednitsa, a liturgy without communion, began. But here, I should take care to add that there was one more person present, Yurovsky. In a complete affront to rank and etiquette, the commandant took great care to stand right up there at the front. Severely tested as they were, the Romanovs were not simply more pious than ever. They were more grave and serious. The last time they had been allowed a religious service, the Empress and Tatiana had sung along with the priest. Even Nikolai Alexandrovich had sung, his bass voice lively and vibrant as he had intoned Our Father. This time, however, none of them sang along, not even the Empress with her beautiful contralto. And when Father Deacon chanted, instead of read, Who Resteth with Saints, the entire family dropped to their knees. Standing behind them, the rest of us, from Botkin on down to me, immediately followed their example. Afterward, we lined up according to rank to kiss the Holy Cross that Father Deacon held in hand. Nikolai Alexandrovich went first, but he hesitated, which even I, way at the back, took note of. Peering around, I tried to see why the Tsar seemed to be taking such a long time with Father Storozhev, to whom he was offering his thanks. And then I understood. The Emperor wanted to pull his note from his pocket and ask Father Storozhev to deliver it to those loyal to him. But this he could not do, for Commandant Yurovsky had so positioned himself to oversee and overhear everything. And so, this, unfortunately, was how the last note fell into my young hands. 15. The 15th, a Monday, was a cool, damp morning that slowly bloomed into a beautiful day. By noon, all of Yekaterinburg was bathed in lovely summer sunshine. Other than that, there was nothing remarkable about the start of the day, nothing to make us suspicious. It was only after lunch, when four charwomen from the labor union were admitted to clean the floors, that events took a serious turn. These women began washing the floors in the Tsar's bedchamber, and Yurovsky stood near them to make sure there was absolutely no conversation between them and the young Grand Duchesses, who were helping move the furniture and talking gaily amongst themselves. Laughing, the girls were. While this was taking place, the Tsar and Tsaritsa relocated to the living room, where Alexander rested on the couch, and Nikolai sat in a chair in the far corner, a novel propped in his lap. By word of trap, I was beckoned from the kitchen to the Tsar, who in a quiet voice asked, "Lyonka, was there no sign of Sister Antonina this morning?" "She did come, Nikolai Alexandrovich. She and her novice came shortly after breakfast, only they were not allowed to proceed as far as the kitchen. Commandant Yurovsky wouldn't let them pass the guard room, which is where I went to get the foodstuffs. I met them there." "And why weren't they allowed any farther?" "That wasn't clear, but Yurovsky asked them a great many questions and looked at everything they carried."
"I see. And what was it they brought today?"
"A chetvert of milk, that was all. No eggs and no cream, either. The commandant said there was to be no more cream.
But what?"
"He did ask them to bring a great many eggs tomorrow. No less than 50.
"Odd. Very odd."
Before continuing, the Tsar glanced across the room to make sure no guards had wandered in.
"There was nothing else?"
"Nets," I whispered. "I checked the cork, but there was nothing."
"I see."
I quickly volunteered, "But I am to go to the Soviet cafeteria in an hour's time. Cook Kharitonov has received permission for me to get more bread."
"Молодец."
"Excellent. I have something I wish to send out."
And then, exactly according to our short tradition, the Tsar entrusted me with a note folded into a small envelope. I wanted to pass this to Father Storozhev yesterday, but that, of course, proved impossible.
I don't know what the note said, for I never saw the actual words, but I've always assumed it was in French just like the others. More of the contents of this note I cannot say, for it alone has been lost to time, undoubtedly because of my stupidity. So, I took the note from the Tsar and kept it carefully tucked in my underclothing until it was time to leave. In the meantime, I was careful not to do anything to attract attention, and when the others went out into the yard for their afternoon walk, I headed off to fetch 6 loaves of chorny chleb, black bread, from the Soviet. By that time, the last 2 of the charwomen, Maria Starodumova and Vasa Dvyagina, had completed their tasks and were also on the way out. As I came through the hall and reached the top of the short staircase, I saw them stopped at the front door.
"There is a new policy," explained Yurovsky, blocking their exit. "From now on, everyone coming into or departing from the house of special purpose will have to be thoroughly searched."
The commandant looked up at me. "I'll get to you, young man, once I've finished with these women." I started shaking. This couldn't be. I was to be searched. Panic shot through my body. Gospody, what if they found the secret note I carried? Then what? Would I be thrown in prison? Shot? What would they do to me? To the imperial family? No, I couldn't let down the emperor. I couldn't fail any of them. My task was far too important, too critical, too. I had to retreat. That was the only course. But where? I turned, started back to the kitchen. I could pull the note from my clothing, hide it somewhere in the house, then be on my way and...
"Lyonka!"
shouted Yurovsky from the bottom of the stairs.
"And just where do you think you're going? You must be on your way. Some of that bread is for us, too, you realize."
There was only one logical explanation, and in a timid voice I replied, "I was just going to go to the toilet, Comrade Commandant. Since you will be a few minutes with these women, I thought, well, I...
"Fine. Just come right back."
Needing no other approval, I bolted. I ran from the front to the back hall, and finally into the small water closet with its toilet and wash sink. I all but slammed the door as I shut it, and fastened the little eye hook, locking myself in. I turned, scanned the walls, which were covered with all those nasty pictures and words about the Tsar and Tsaritsa. There was, however, no little place to stash the note. No cabinet, no loose plank. What should I do? Rip up the envelope and flush it down the drain? Tear it up and eat it? Oh, if only I had done one of those. Instead, My eyes fell upon a large pipe above the toilet itself. Convinced I had no other choice, I pulled the note from my clothing, stood on the toilet seat, and tucked the note right back there, right behind the metal pipe. I jumped down and looked up, unable to see a thing. It would be safe there, at least until my return, and I unfastened the lock and pushed the door. Then stopped, reaching back. I flushed the toilet, and was on my way again, confident I'd covered my tracks. Before I left the house, I was indeed searched, though not as thoroughly as I feared. In fact, had I still been carrying the note, the commandant probably wouldn't have discovered it at all. I did overhear Yurovsky say to one of the charwomen, Maria Starodunova, that a good number of things had been pilfered from the family, which was so very unrevolutionary. Perhaps that was why he was searching everyone. But I doubt it. I think Yurovsky wasn't looking for little spoons or watches, skirts or leather boots, that kind of thing. No, I think he was looking for a man of jewels. And I think that was why the sister Antonina and novice Marina chose not to come in that morning. They were afraid of being searched. Rather, they just left their goods. Who knows? Maybe Sister Antonina was, in fact, transporting something more than a note. Perhaps even a weapon. I have never found an answer to that question. So, I was searched and released without incident. I went directly to the Soviet, where, of course, I gathered the bread. 3 loaves for the guards and 3 for us. It was very tasty, nice and sour, though I knew the Empress wouldn't eat any, for she felt black bread was much too dense and gave her headaches. Then again, had she consulted Commandant Yurovsky, he probably would have gone on at length with his advice. He probably would have stated that her headaches came from malnutrition, which they very well might have, since the Empress ate so very little. Having gotten out of the house undiscovered, I was feeling very smart as I returned, very clever indeed. There had been a terrible crisis, and I, Lyonka Sednyov, the kitchen boy, had solved it. The dreaded commandant had been about to discover the Tsar's secret dealings with his monarchist officers, and I'd saved the day, entirely on my own, yes, indeed. And a very fine officer I myself would make some day, of that I was sure. Once this revolution was over, and once the Tsar was back in power again, I imagined that I was destined for great service, great reward, perhaps even great riches. Various members of the nobility, like Prince Arlov, for example, had thus been so rewarded for their extraordinary services to their masters. So, I returned to the House of Special Purpose, all but whistling. I delivered the 3 loaves to the guard room, whereupon Yurovsky quickly searched my body once again. Cleared, I proceeded up to the kitchen, where I put 3 loaves on the maple table. Next, I headed directly for the WC, planning to fetch the note from its hiding place and secretly return it to the Tsar, telling him how I'd single-handedly averted disaster. So, I went into the small WC, shut the door, and dropped the hook into the little eye. I climbed atop the toilet, stuck my hand back there, but when I reached behind the pipe, I found nothing. Yet, nothing. There was absolutely ничего behind the pipe. I suppose it wasn't much more than an hour earlier that I had carefully hidden the note back there, but now, to my dismay, the little envelope had vanished. And so overcome with panic was I that I nearly vomited. I clawed at the walls, searched the floor, looked everywhere, hoping it had merely dropped out and was lying around. In desperation, I pulled at the back of the toilet itself, even opened the tank, but there was no trace whatsoever of the Tsar's note to his loyal officers. My only hope, of course, was that the Tsar himself, or someone else from the family, had found it. I hurried out of the water closet, through the kitchen, and into the dining room, where I found the Tsar and Tsaritsa playing a game of bezique. "Do you realize Dr. Derevenka hasn't been allowed in once since the new commandant?" she bemoaned as she studied her cards. "We will keep asking, and asking.
Baby's going to take a bath tonight. Imagine, it's only his second since Tobolsk.
In case you hadn't heard, the commandant says we bathe too much. We must stop this continual washing. It's not a good habit, or so he claims, said the Tsar with amusement. After all, he's
a trained medic.
They both started chuckling. I cleared my throat. Nikolai Alexandrovich turned to me and exclaimed,
Ah, Lonka, all is well?
I felt their eyes upon me, both the Tsar's and the Tsaritsa's. So hopeful they looked, so yearning for good news. I wanted to cry. I wanted to shout out, for by the simplicity on their royal faces, I immediately understood that no, it wasn't them who had found and claimed the note. Dear Lord in heaven. Seeing my confusion, the Tsar asked, Your trip to the Soviet for Chleb was a success? Had there not been a guard by the window, I'm sure I would have burst into tears and confessed my stupidity. Had we been alone, I'm sure I would have dropped to the floor and admitted how terribly I had failed, blurting that the note most surely had fallen into the hands of the Reds who guarded us. As it was, there was nothing I could say. Not only because of the nearby Lett with rifle and hand grenade, but, truth be told, because I was far too much of a coward. My voice shaking, I muttered, Das. While the Empress was not a well-educated woman and by no means wise, she was extraordinarily perceptive. And if she called you a friend, then she cared for you with her entire being. She knew something was wrong. And seeing me shake, she immediately rose to her feet and pressed her hand to my forehead in a smothering, motherly way.
Nicky, the boy's burning up.
She immediately summoned Dr. Botkin, who pronounced the onslaught of grip, and as such I was immediately sentenced to the back bedroom, the far corner one. I was covered with blankets, offered tea and broth, both of which I declined. I just lay there, terrified of what I had done, what would happen, and wanting so much to confess and beg forgiveness. Instead, I lay there all evening, unable to speak. Much to my amazement, however, everything else seemed to proceed with complete normalcy. Alexei did, in fact, have his bath. The family retired early, the wind came up, and somewhere in the depth of the night I heard both thunder and the report of artillery. And I lay there, listening for that elusive whistle and praying, Please, please, come tonight. Please, come and carry us away this very eve. By morning, it seemed but a dream. Or, rather, a nightmare that passed like the midnight storm, for nothing had changed. I woke cool and calm. First the Empress herself checked on me, feeling again my forehead, and then the doctor did likewise. I was pronounced healthy, surprisingly healthy. Meanwhile, it was noted that Alexei had come down with a slight cold, caught from me, they speculated, and it was hoped he would recover just as quickly. This was the 16th, of course. July 16th, the day thereof. Yet, as far as I could tell, there were no suspicions, no thoughts or fears of what was to come. At least, not by any of them, the family. This I knew, because I studied them all day long, trying to figure out who had found this stupid note. I could learn nothing, however. And the time just progressed into another boring day. I suppose it was infinitely better that way, better they didn't suspect, better they couldn't conceive of anything as terrible as that which would transpire that very night. That morning, eggs, milk, and thread were once again brought from the monastery. Sister Antonina and Novice Marina came early, but I did not see them. Rather, they left the foodstuffs with the guards at the front door. And while a good many eggs they did in fact bring, we received only 10.
The evidence of the other eggs, all 40 of them, I was to see only later. Otherwise, for the rest of the day, the Empress and Olga, her eldest, madly continued arranging medicines. It was late that afternoon, too, that they completed the long and difficult task of individually wrapping every diamond in cotton wadding, and then densely packing and stitching those little bundles between two corsets for the girls to wear. And just in time, too. That night, when Yurovsky woke them, the Grand Duchesses would slip on their corsets, each of which was packed with no less than 10,000 carats. They would get dressed, sure that 300 officers were charging to their rescue, and Alexandra would think herself so smart, so clever. And yet, a horrific cloud of doubt must have hovered in the Tsaritsa's mind. While Nikolai was a slave to fate, Alexandra believed in the duality of the prophecies, that what was written in the Bible of ancient times applied as well to her, a fallen queen. In the afternoon, while Nikolai was pacing outside in the garden for his 30 minutes, Alexandra and her second daughter, Tatiana, remained inside, reading of the prophet's gloom, including, "Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord." As for me, I became less worried as the day wore on. As far as I could see, no one in our suite had found the note, nor had Yurovsky or any of the guards apparently discovered it, for there was no recrimination, no horrible scene. Little did I know, however, that the note had, in fact, been found by the Reds, and that the entire day telegrams were flying to and from Moscow demanding that Nikolai be immediately destroyed. 16. Lenin denied it all. During those tumultuous days, those violent days, when the outside world couldn't tell what happened to Nikolai and Alexandra, Lenin claimed that the ex-Tsar was safe, that the rumors of their murders were only a provocation and lie of capitalist press. But Lenin knew. Of course he did. For on that day, Tuesday, July 16, 1918, he authorized not only the execution of Nikolai, but the entire family, including all the girls and the boy. That was what kind of man he was, a cold-blooded murderer. "I spit on the bastard's body, which to this day lies like a pickle in a glass coffin on Moscow's Red Square. A shrine to a mass murderer. That's what it is." I never learned who discovered the envelope I hid in the bathroom, but it soon fell into Commandant Yurovsky's hands, who in turn sounded the bloodthirsty alarm. And the discovery of that note from the Tsar to his would-be rescuers, his officers, caused a terrible fright among the Communisti. Expecting imminent defeat and seeing monarchist spies in every shadow and around every corner, some of the Reds fled into the forest and hills. Others slipped out of town and secretly crossed over enemy lines, where the double-crossing bastards swore allegiance to the Whites. Yet others, a core group of Reds, gathered at the American Hotel, a fine brick building down by the train station. It was there, in room number 3, that these bloodthirsty Bolsheviki celebrated. For at last, here it was, their excuse, and to Moscow they issued an urgent request. To destroy him and the family and relatives of the former Tsar. In case of refusal, we have decided to carry out this decree using our own forces. Gospody, dear Lord. It was my fault that the note was found, that the plot to rescue them was exposed, and that the Tsar and his family were executed before they could be rescued. When I question myself, when I begin to doubt or even, perhaps, forgive myself, I take out my dossier.
and I read these documents, and in each line I see the truth. The Presidium of the Ural Regional Soviet of the Workers' and Peasants'